Good evening. Welcome to tonight's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Gina Bellaria, the former director of literary events here at the Commonwealth Club, founder and consultant for Bellaria Creative. It is my pleasure to introduce Sumbul Ali Karamali, author of The Muslim Next Door, The Quran, The Media, and That Veil Thing, here tonight to talk about Sharia law. Today, Ms. Ali Karamali will work to clear up misconceptions that have taken hold in the U.S. and demystify images of Sharia and Sharia law. Ali Karamali is an attorney with a graduate degree in Islamic law. She grew up in Southern California, the daughter of Muslim parents from South Asia. Before going to law school, she studied English at Stanford University and spent time working as an editor at a publishing house. She received her Juris Doctorate at UC Davis School of Law and her LLM in Islamic Law at the University of London School of Oriental and African Studies. While in London, Ali Karamali taught Islamic law and worked as a research associate at the Center of Islamic and Middle Eastern Law in London. Ali Karamali then practiced corporate law in San Francisco and has authored many articles. She currently focuses on speaking engagements and media interviews, writing, and raising her two children. She's on the board of trustees of a nonprofit educational institution that teaches about multiculturalism and the environment, and she serves on the steering committee of Women in Islamic Spirituality and Equality, WISE. It's an initiative dedicated to social justice. In her spare time, Ali Karamali plays violin, teaches Indian cooking, and watches Star Trek reruns with her husband. Please welcome Sumbul Ali Karamali.
I just have to make sure my cell phone is off. It wasn't. Well, thank you very much. I was looking forward to doing this, partly because when I was growing up in L.A. is my excuse for a lot of things, but when I was growing up in L.A., I had never heard the word Sharia. I went to Sunday school. I grew up in a devout Muslim family. I had never heard this word, Sharia. When I went to Stanford, and in fact, as I was growing up, I didn't know very many other Muslims. And I was the oldest of the Muslims I did know who were growing up here. And so often I got all these questions. And actually, do you know the Star Trek concept of first contact? You know, where you meet an alien species and you have to be really cautious and wary. Well, that was me. I was the first contact for a lot of these people that I was. And so I got asked a lot of questions, but never Sharia. We never talked about it. It actually wasn't until I did my degree in Islamic law that I heard this word. And so it's amazing to me that now it's become part of the discourse. And the press uses it all the time. Usually wrongly, but it's just something that's become part of our public discourse. I was on CNN a few months ago, and they kept asking me, so what does it mean that the Taliban are bringing back Sharia law? And I kept saying, the Taliban are violating Sharia. And there we were at an impasse, because she would say, but what does it mean that the Taliban are bringing back Sharia law? So that's how big a gulf there is between Islam and public perceptions of Islam. So I'm going to define Sharia, hopefully, for you today. But to do that, I need to talk a little bit about Islam first and give you some basics. Muhammad was the prophet of Islam. He was born in 570 in Mecca in what is now Saudi Arabia. If you'd rather not think of him as a prophet, you can think of him as a social reformer. His society in Arabia was tribal, nomadic. There was no central authority. There was no government. Whether you were protected depended on how powerful your tribe was. Tribal raiding was a matter of life, and war was a default state. So the only day of the year where war was not the default state, and there was an exception, and there was a truce, was on the day of the annual poetry festival in Mecca. And don't you just love this image? You have all these people going around with their tribal raiding and their weapons, and suddenly someone says, oh my gosh, you guys, it's the poetry festival! And they all throw down their weapons and rush to downtown Mecca. So it was a very patriarchal society. There was unlimited polygyny, which is one man to several wives. This was practiced by the Arab pagans as well as the Arab Jews. Partly because all that tribal raiding left a lot of widows and orphans. And women had very few rights and could be sold into marriage or sent away from a marriage without their children. So Muhammad was a merchant in this society, and he was very concerned with social justice. And so he had a practice of meditating. And it was when he was 40 years old and meditating one day that he received his first revelation from God. And Muslims believe that the angel Gabriel brought the words of God to the Prophet Muhammad. Throughout his life, for the next 20 years, Muhammad received many of these revelations, and he would recite the words out loud, and his followers would write them down on whatever bits of paper they had to hand. And all of these bits of paper were compiled within 20 years of his death and made into a document that we now call the Quran. And I was telling this to a friend of mine who is from Mexico, and she's Catholic, and she kept saying, "The angel Gabriel brought these words? The same angel Gabriel?" And actually, yes, it's the same angel Gabriel, because Islam accepts the Judeo-Christian worldview. When Muhammad started preaching, he didn't see himself as preaching a new religion. He saw himself as preaching the religion of Abraham, or the religion of one God. And he saw himself as, at least at the beginning, as preaching a sort of supplement to the Judeo-Christian religion. So just as Christianity accepts within it Judaism, with some differences, Islam accepts Judaism and Christianity within it, with some differences. So Muslims accept the Judeo-Christian prophets as well, Moses, Jesus, Adam, Noah, Solomon, David, etc. Now, Allah, by the way, is just the Arabic word for God, just as Dios is the Spanish word for God and Dieu is the French word for God. It's not a proper name. It's not a proper noun. It's not the name of a god like Zeus is. It just means God. And historically, Arab Christians and Jews also called their god Allah. So, this is the first time I'm doing a PowerPoint presentation. I wasn't going to tell you, but if I mess up, you'll have to forgive me. So, the five pillars of Islam are the tenets of Islam, the basic tenets of Islam. And, oh, it worked. That's where they are. There is the Declaration of Faith, which is that you believe that there is only one God, and Muhammad is the messenger of God. There is prayer five times daily, fasting during the month of Ramadan from dawn to sunset for 29 or 30 days, donation to charity, and pilgrimage to Mecca in Saudi Arabia once in your lifetime if you can afford it. Those are the five pillars. I was speaking to a high school and one kid said, I thought killing infidels was a pillar of Islam. And I said, no, it's just these five. So the Quran, as the word of God, what Muslims believe is the word of God, is the main source of Islam. That was how it all started. Sometimes, you know, once in a while I've come across someone who says, well, until you rewrite the Quran, we really have nothing to say. And so I just wanted to say the Quran cannot be rewritten because Muslims believe it's the word of God, and you can't rewrite the word of God. It's like saying to a Christian, we can't talk until you stop believing in Jesus Christ. There are some beliefs that are just integral to a religion, and one of them is that the Quran is the word of God. That doesn't mean that our understanding of the Quran cannot change, but it means that the Quran itself cannot change. So, here we go. The Quran, which means recitation, is an unmetered verse. It's made up of 30 surahs or chapters, and it has over 6,300 ayahs or verses. That is the main source of Islam. Now, the second is the sunnah, and the sunnah is the Arabic name for the customs and sayings of the Prophet Muhammad. Muslims believe that these are considered divine. They don't believe that Muhammad was divine, but his actions were divinely guided, and so his words and deeds are considered divine. Now, the hadith is our record of his sayings. Sometimes, even though his words and deeds were divine, our record isn't, right? Our record is man-made. And the hadith was preserved in an oral tradition, and it was written down a few hundred years after the Prophet. So it's still evidence, it's still a source of Islam, but it has to be taken in the context of being an oral tradition. So it's hard, for instance, to keep human error from entering into preservation of such of a tradition like that. And in fact, the early Muslim scholars acknowledged that some people had circulated forgeries, hadith that were not really hadith, but they wanted to further agendas. And what better way than to say, oh, well, the Prophet said such and such thing, right? So so they did their best to record the hadith. But, you know, I heard one sheikh say that it's one part true history, one part mythology, and one part ninth century viewpoints. But even so, these are the two primary sources of Islam and Islamic law. Now, the Quran and the Sunnah were not, after the Prophet died, the Quran and the Sunnah were not really enough to really tell people all the answers to what they wanted to know, right? Like, if they wanted to know, well, how exactly do I pray? Or what should I say when I pray? Or is it okay to drink water when I fast? I mean, the Quran and Sunnah didn't necessarily address some of those questions. And so what the early Muslims started to do was they started to analyze the Quran and the Sunnah and write lots of interpretive literature. So they filled books and books and books of interpretive literature analyzing the Quran and the Sunnah. This is called the fiqh. It means understanding. It refers to the body of literature interpreting the Quran and Sunnah. Most of it, a lot of it was written between the 7th and 10th centuries. And it's also called Islamic jurisprudence. And it's not unlike the Jewish Talmud. It's just writings on and development of the rules and development of the religion. Now, they developed the fiqh. The early Muslim scholars developed the fiqh by using certain methodologies. They used analogy. For example, if the Quran said something, they would analogize it to a different situation. The Quran says that alcohol and drunkenness are forbidden. Muslims interpreted that to mean all intoxicants are forbidden. The consensus of the Muslim scholars, if all the Muslim scholars agreed on one particular thing, then that became a general rule in the fiqh, in the works of jurisprudence. Custom was also something that they took into account. The public interest, what's good for public policy. And also they used ijtihad, which is called independent reasoning. So if they couldn't find anything in the other scholars' works, they would go back to the sacred texts and analyze them and interpret them anew. So a few points to remember about the fiqh is that historically it was never so important. The implementation of the religious law was never so important as the theory and the analysis of it. So a lot of it was like an exercise in logic. And also, the early Muslims were necessarily taking their historical situations into account, right? Because they're looking at custom, they're looking at public interest, and those things are dependent on when and where you're living. So those are just a few things to remember. So you had all these in the early centuries of Islam. You had all these people developing the religious law. Now, if a qualified Muslim scholar... I mean, how did this happen? If a qualified Muslim scholar came up with a reasoned opinion on one of these issues that were derived from the Quran and Sunnah, then this reasoned opinion was called a fatwa. Now, a fatwa was not divine. It wasn't enforceable. It wasn't binding. But it had to be a qualified Islamic scholar who was using the methodology and laying a foundation. And in a way, it's not that different from a opinion from a law firm. So if you go to a law firm and you say, I want a legal opinion on something or other, then they look at case law, they look at statutes, they look at public policy, they make an argument, they come up and they give you an opinion, right? It's not binding. It's their opinion. But it's based on a certain methodology, and that's what the fatwa was. Extremist rhetoric by al-Qaeda is not a fatwa. When we invaded Iraq, I remember an imam, Ali Sistani, urged his followers to cooperate with the Americans. And I remember that Paul Wolfowitz eagerly hailed this as the first pro-American fatwa. It was not a fatwa. It was just an opinion. He was saying, cooperate with the Americans. And these days there are lots of idiotic fatwas floating around. I mean, there really are. If you hear about all kinds of nonsense, and I'm embarrassed to say this, but there was just a fatwa by a Saudi cleric who said, and you have to remember that the Saudis are very extreme on the spectrum of Muslims. And he said that those who believed in the mixing of genders in the workplace should be killed. He was roundly criticized by even other Saudi clerics. And this is not acceptable. I mean, this is not accepted. And it's really no different from Jerry Falwell saying that gays and lesbians were responsible for 9/11 or that, the Haitian earthquake occurred because the Haitians are cursed. There's the religious leaders, but they say these things, and we all have crazy people in our religions. So, didn't mean to say that. So, anyway, this is really important because you hear a lot of dogma these days. You hear a lot of Islam says this, Islam says that. But the fact is that Islamic law accepted variations of interpretations within it. So when scholars issued a fatwa, they would say, and God knows best, which means that I did my best, but really God is the one who knows, and I'm just trying to guess at the mind of God. And the Prophet himself said that differences in his community were blessings from God. You know, I was at a book talk, and a woman came up to me, and she grew up in the Jesuit tradition. And if I'm getting this wrong, forgive me, I'm just saying what she said. But she said, in the Jesuit tradition, there's a sin of presumption, that if you have two learned scholars, and they both have, in good faith, come up with opinions, then you can't say that one is right and one is wrong, because that would be a sin of presumption. And I thought, I really like that, because this is what it's like in Islam as well. There were all these Muslim scholars, they issued their fatwas, and there were debates and diversity in their opinions, but that was okay, because Islam is not one thing. It's a range of beliefs and practices, right? Within parameters. But there's a lot, as much variation within it as any other religion. So just for an example, you know, some Muslim scholars early on said abortion was always allowed until the birth of the child. Some said abortion was never allowed after conception. And some said abortion was allowed before the soul entered the body. Well, as a Muslim, what do you do? Well, you pray for guidance, and you choose, you go with your conscience. But that's how it worked. So now we have the Quran and the Sunnah and the Fiqh, right? The Quran and the Sunnah are divine. The Fiqh is the man-made interpretations of the Quran and the Sunnah. So what's Sharia? This is what we hear about all the time. Sharia means the way of God. And there are six principles of Sharia derived from the Quran. And these are the protection of life, the protection of education, the protection of family, the protection of property, which is the access to resources, the protection of religion, and the protection of human dignity. These are not unlike American constitutional principles, right? These were developed over 1,000 years ago. This is one reason why, when CNN was asking me, what does it mean that the Taliban is bringing back Sharia? I kept saying, the Taliban are violating Sharia. Now, what's the difference between Sharia and Fiqh? This is really important, because oftentimes in the usage, these two get mixed up. So Sharia is the way of God. Literally, it means the road to the watering place. And if you're in the desert, that's a really poetic image. So Sharia is the way of God, and Fiqh is the man-made attempt to understand the way of God, right? Sharia is divine and doesn't change, but fiqh, our understanding of Sharia, can change because it's not divine. What's confusing for people is that people refer to Sharia in all kinds of ways. So sometimes Sharia is, you know, the six principles of Sharia are what's being referred to. Sometimes people refer to the Quran and the Sunnah as the Sharia. Sometimes refer to the Quran and the Sunnah and the Fiqh as Sharia, and sometimes it just means Islam. So this makes it very difficult. You have to understand what your context is. And this is why, ultimately, that I never heard this word growing up, right? I came from a non-Arabic speaking family. My family was from India. There was no reason for me to know about this word Sharia, because I grew up with Islamic principles. I was following Islam. I was Muslim. That's all really I needed to know, right? You don't need to articulate these principles in order to live them. So it wasn't something that was in my consciousness. And then finally, I wanted to say, even though the subject of this talk was what is Sharia law, I really hate that term. I really hate that term, Sharia law, because it implies that it's binding and enforceable and state-made and imposed. And that's not what it was meant to be. It's law the way the Ten Commandments is law. It's religious law. And actually, in the press, it's often insulting, too, because it's usually used to refer to things like the Taliban's criminal actions, which are not Sharia. So this is also this whole thing, the Quran and the Sunnah and the Fiqh, everything is what's referred to when people say Islamic law. So when I have a degree in Islamic law, this is what they're talking about, the Quran and the Sunnah and the Fiqh. Historically, how did Islamic law work? How did it figure in? Well, people are often very surprised to know that historically, government and religion in Islam were separate. So the institutions that governed were always separate from the institutions that developed the religion. The religious scholars never governed. So actually, in 1979, when Khomeini took over in Iran, that was the first time in 1,400 years of Islamic history that religious scholars had been given a mandate to govern. It's very controversial. It's not agreed still by everybody, by all Muslims. Now, historically, then, if these were separate, court judgments were usually a mix of regional law, customary law, Islamic law, policy, and it really depended on where you were in the Islamic Empire. Plus, Islamic civilization was always multi-religious and multicultural, and so non-Muslims living under Muslim rule had their own laws and sometimes their own courts, and so they were ruled by their own laws, especially when it came to personal status like marriage and divorce. Now, in the 19th century, the Muslim world began to be colonized, and that's when there became this amalgamation of Western law and Islamic law. So in 1850, the Ottomans drafted this document called the Majella, which was actually a codification of Sharia based on the French Civil Code. French Civil Code, yes. And when many Muslim countries gained independence, you know, a lot of the world was colonized until the mid-20th century. So when they gained independence in the mid-20th century, they enacted civil codes based on the French or Swiss civil code systems. So most of the Middle East now does have the civil law system, not the common law system. And the exception was, and also, they enacted these codes, but they also claimed to have variously claimed to have elements of fiqh in them. So they would throw in, you know, elements of Sharia in them. The exception was Turkey, which completely abolished Islamic law in 1926. Now, and even Iran, which, you know, purports to be an Islamic state, has a constitution that predates 1979, and it has a civil code that predates 1979. I think it was actually amended in order to throw in some so-called Islamic provisions, but it's still a constitution. They're all constitutional states with codes. And the reason I wanted to say this is because when Obama was running for president, there was an op-ed in the New York Times, and it was by somebody saying that Muslims had an obligation to assassinate Obama because Obama's father was Muslim and he wasn't Muslim and therefore he was an apostate and could be killed. This was nonsense on a lot of different levels, but the level that's concerning me here is that it assumes that all Muslims in the world are ruled by some sort of general principles of Sharia, right? It's like saying that all Catholics in the world are bound to do something or other, or all Jews in the world are bound to do something that comes out of 9th century law, right? That's not how it works. Saudi Arabia is worth mentioning too, because it's different from everybody else pretty much. It purports to be an Islamic state, but it's actually an absolute monarchy that's largely ruled by tribal and customary laws, not Islamic law. In fact, one of my professors was a Christian Lebanese, and I remember he said, the problem with Saudi Arabia is that it doesn't have enough Islamic law, which is a very surprising statement, you would think, from a Christian Lebanese. And maybe you'll see why he said that a little bit further on. But, and the Saudi laws are a result of a very patriarchal, conservative culture. Okay, so the characteristics of Islamic law. Okay, generally, it doesn't look that different from what we think of as Western law, because generally, like all legal systems, it's concerned with fairness and justice and not killing people and not stealing and that sort of thing. There are three general areas where it does look different, though, and those are the ones that you hear about a lot, so I thought I would mention those. And the first is criminal law. Okay. So, Islamic criminal law has general principles, and these are four of them, which are that all things are permissible unless explicitly made impermissible. Everyone is to be treated equally before the law. Everyone is presumed innocent until proven guilty. And the accused gets the benefit of the doubt. And I wanted to say this, too, because just recently a very nice man said, he asked me, in Islam, is everyone guilty until proven innocent? And my mind kind of boggled at this, like this idea that everybody in the world was guilty and we all had to hire lawyers to prove our innocence. So those are general principles of criminal law. Originally, Islamic criminal law was meant to be a limitation on violence. So a life for a life was better than 10 lives for a life or 100 lives for a life. It's like other ancient laws. It was also deterrent because it's trying to get people to behave better. And it's homiletic, which means that sometimes the penalties were there to illustrate the severity of the crime, but not actually to be implemented. There's a passage in the Bible, for example, that says disobedient children should be killed. That's generally understood to be homiletic, you know? But when we think of Islamic criminal law today, we often think of harsh and brutal punishments. And the way that they have been applied recently, they are harsh and brutal. So I wanted to talk about adultery as a common example, because I'm sure we've all heard of women being stoned to death for adultery or executed for adultery. And this is rare, and it only takes place in a few places, but it's horrible that it happens at all. And so I thought I would explain what's going on and why this is a miscarriage of justice. In my opinion. So, the penalty in the Quran for extramarital sex is actually the same for men as for women, and it's not execution. 1,400 years ago, the Quran said that adulterers, both the woman and the man, should be given 100 lashes. That was the penalty, but somehow execution came into the fiqh, right? The man-made books of jurisprudence. And no one's exactly sure how it got there, perhaps because stoning was the penalty in the Jewish tradition and Muslims considered themselves very close to Jews and brother, like sibling religions. But stoning is also the penalty in the Bible, so it was something that was a concept back then. But wherever it came from, in Islamic law, in the fiqh, the penalty for unmarried persons became 100 lashes, and the penalty for married persons became execution. But let me tell you, even under medieval Islamic law, what you have to satisfy to convict somebody for adultery. In order to prove a criminal case for adultery against either a man or a woman, you must produce 4 eyewitnesses to the act of intercourse itself. How many lawyers are out in the audience? I wouldn't want this kind of burden of proof. Moreover, it's not enough to have seen two people under a coverlet. You actually have to see everything. Okay. It's also not enough. The prosecutor also has to show that each of those 4 witnesses who saw everything has to be honest and trustworthy, because perjury is itself a severe penalty under Islamic law. You must show that the intercourse was lawful. You must show that the intercourse was unlawful. And even if the prosecutor can meet this burden of proof, the penalty can be mitigated or abolished if the defendant can show duress, fraud, lack of capacity, decreased capacity, mistake, or repentance. Now, even if the prosecutor can show all these things, the 4 eyewitnesses, and even if the defendant cannot show any of these defenses, you know, by some sort of cosmic convergence, the court may still decide that there is some doubt, however small, and not apply the penalty. also, even if that doesn't work, the court can always just pardon the defendant and nullify the punishment. So, oh, by the way, in an unmarried woman's pregnancy is not proof of adultery either under Islamic law. So this is an impossible burden of proof. This is an impossible crime to actually prove. In fact, some have argued that this was actually a crime that was aimed towards public lewdness, and that was the purpose of it, was because how else would you have four eyewitnesses? And in fact, some scholars, again, view this as a homiletic crime. This was something that was, you know, meant to show the severity, but not to be implemented. And indeed, in Islamic history, it was very rarely implemented. In fact, in the 1920s, when Saudi Arabia executed a woman for adultery, there was shock throughout the Muslim world because nobody had been executed for a very long time. So, executing someone for adultery is always a miscarriage of justice. And when you hear about it, well, I'm going to go on because I'm running out of time. Okay. So criminal law is one area. Finance is the other area. And I was going to give you a long and boring lecture on finance, but I decided to just give you some general principles instead. And anyway, I'm not an expert on Islamic finance. There are people who are Islamic finance practitioners. And okay. So generally, the law of contracts in Islam is similar. There's offer, acceptance. It varies in some small particulars, but they're not hurdles. They're easy to get around. It's like different customs. But there are a couple areas where you do come across sort of hurdles or stumbling blocks. And this is what they are. The first is riba. It's variously defined, but it generally means usury. The second is gharar, which is the word for risk or uncertainty or speculation. And the third is that you have to invest in permissible enterprises, which means that you shouldn't be investing in prostitution, gambling, or war profiteering enterprises. Now, riba is the one that you've probably heard of, because usually that's translated as interest, and people can't take, Islamic banks don't take interest, is what you might have heard. It actually doesn't mean interest. It's in the Quran, and you're not supposed to do it, but there's no precise definition of it. And what the Quran was referring to was a situation in 6th or 7th century Arabia where the borrower would borrow money and then it would become due. And on the due date, the lender would say, do you pay or do you double? And if the borrower couldn't pay, then he owed double the amount until the next due date. And so this kind of went on like this. And this was clearly riba. This was what riba was referring to. It was clearly usury. It enslaved the borrower, and that was not considered fair and just. So the question then is, well, what exactly is riba? What's usury? And this whole concept is not a unique one. Aristotle despised interest, and it's disapproved of in the Bible as well. But there are lots of interpretations of what usury is or what riba is. Not everybody agrees. So generally, compound interest is considered usury, or riba, sorry, because it's interest on interest, and that sounds a lot like the doubling situation. Some scholars have said that any interest is prohibited, but some say it's only excessive interest, and some say simple interest up to a cap is okay. The Jordanian Civil Code of the 70s, I think, said interest up to 7% was okay. One scholar in Egypt, who's really prominent, says interest is not the issue at all here in riba. He says it's really exploitation that's the issue. And so a distinction should be made between economic loans and loans to poor people to help them meet their basic needs. And it's economic enslavement of the borrower that's what's unjust, and that's what constitutes riba. Another scholar says that Islamic banks are no different from regular banks because it's just form over substance. And the real issue is that financial transactions have clarity and justice, because if they don't have clarity and justice, then that is riba. So you can see that the interpretations and the definitions are all over the place. Now, in terms of practical applications, since the 1970s, Islamic banking has really taken off. And Muslim countries are still dominated by Western banking, but Islamic banks are an alternative now. And Muslims have generally structured their financial translations to comply with the principles of Islam, just like in the West, Westerners constructed their financial transactions. I need some water. Okay, just as we in the West structured our financial translations to meet our needs, that's what they're doing in Islamic banking. Many have Sharia advisory councils to tell them whether a particular translation is Sharia compliant. There are these words again that are... So to avoid the riba prohibition, what you can do is enter into general partnership agreements. So what isn't really allowed is just sitting back and getting a fixed interest on your money. What is good is to invest in things and to have your money work for you. So profit sharing, risk sharing, investing in the stock market, these are all good things to do. General partnership agreements are always good things to do. And also sort of markup schemes where instead of interest, you're paying a fee to the bank, processing fee is how they're often structured. So, and there are lots of different instruments that they've come up with to satisfy these requirements. Now the second one, gharar, is a little bit easier. It's the other big prohibition. It's the accumulation of wealth that's based on chance outcomes that's not permitted. So, for example, gambling is not okay because the outcome is based on chance and not other factors. Insurance is not okay because you don't know when you're going to die, and that's completely up to chance. And life insurance. Futures contracts are not okay because that's betting on whether something goes up or down. Now, this is not a prohibition against all risk. Business risk is good, like profit sharing, but it's where the outcome only rests on chance that's the problem. And actually, what's interesting, I was just told that I've just been reading that Islamic mutual funds actually did very well in the current financial crisis because they didn't invest in banks. That and in fact, Islamic banking generally did better than average because they just kind of avoided the whole subprime mortgage fiasco. Because they don't take interest. Okay, so do I have like a?
Definitely.
Okay, I can keep going.
5 minutes.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So the third. I mentioned three areas where Islamic law tends to differ, and criminal law, finance, and the third one that I wanted to talk about was family law. And this we hear about quite a bit. There's no slide, I'm sorry. You all looked over at the slide. But family law comes up a lot because one of the things that I'm most asked about is why are Muslim women so oppressed? And you know, that's a whole nother lecture that I do. But that's in the area of family law. And there is probably no other area in Islam that's been so infused with dogma and also that's been so affected by past and present cultural norms, especially the status of women. So one thing I wanted to ask you to do is when you're thinking of Islam and women, keep in mind that our modern ideas of gender justice are pretty new. For instance, the Swiss women only got the right to vote in 1971. So this is a fairly new idea. For the 7th century, some of these ideas were very radical. In the 7th century, one of the clear objectives of the Quran was to increase the rights of women. It was to promote the status of women. And it is said, with some justice, that Islam in the 7th century Arabia gave women more rights than English women would have for another 1,000 years. So why have we gone backward? Well, first of all, the rights that were so radically feminist for the 7th century are not on their face what we think of as gender justice today. And secondly, cultural patriarchal interpretations of Islam really limited the impact of the Quran. For example, in 7th century Arabia, women didn't get anything as a matter of right in terms of inheritance. Everything went to the strongest male who could protect the tribe, which was usually the son. And it made sense. I mean, the son went to battle. He protected the tribe. He needed the assets. Do you guys all remember Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, how the Bennet sisters didn't get anything and Mr. Collins, a distant cousin, got the whole thing? Well, so this wasn't so different, right? I mean, the women didn't inherit very well under a lot of systems. So the Quran introduced 9 new heirs of inheritance, most of them women. For example, the Quran said if somebody died and left a daughter and a son, the daughter would get 1/3 of the estate and the son would get 2/3. Now, 1/3 of the estate was huge. And in fact, there was a lot of backlash against this. What do you mean the daughter gets 1/3? What's she going to do? She's not going to go do tribal raiding. It was shocking. But it doesn't seem fair now, does it? I mean, I have a son and a daughter and I want to give them half and half. So what do we do? Well, Muslims today will often say, well, that wasn't an end in itself, that 1/3. That 1/3 was an example of how to achieve gender justice, right? It was predicated on the historical situation of the time. It was dependent on what women earned at the time. Now women can earn more. There's no reason for them to only get 1/3. Some Muslims wouldn't agree with me, and they would say, no, you take a literalist interpretation of the Quran, and you say it's 1/3 and 2/3. And this is not, again, this is typical too, isn't it? I mean, all religions have their literalists and their non-literalists. And in fact, we're still fighting over the Second Amendment, who gets to bear arms, and that wasn't even so old. So, okay. Okay, so I've been talking about, for the most part, traditional Islamic law, right? Islamic law that has, that was really developed over the centuries, a lot of it a long time ago. And there is this perception that it's static, that because it was developed mostly in the 7th to 10th centuries, it hasn't gone away, it hasn't progressed at all. In fact, a lot of times, the people seem to assume that the Saudis are the original form of Islam, the medieval original form. And what's interesting is that the Saudis are Wahhabis, and the Wahhabi movement is actually a recent one. It originated in the 18th century in Saudi Arabia. It was an extremist movement that was denounced by Muslim scholars at the time as extremist, and it would have fizzled out, except that the Wahhabis teamed up with the Al Saud family, who wanted to take over the Arabian Peninsula. And so when Saudi Arabia was founded, Wahhabism became the state religion. Oftentimes, I hear on NPR, they'll say, you know, Saudis are leaders of the Muslim world, or it's Islam Central, I've heard other people say, or it's the purest form of Islam. And the fact is that Wahhabism is very much Arab culture mixed into Islam. And the Saudis, what I like to tell people, are 1.5% of the Muslim world. They are disproportionately representative because they have money, because they're our Western allies, and because they're in charge of the holy places, Mecca and Medina. But generally, you know, there have been other movements as well. There have been reform movements and renewal movements throughout all of Islam. And in fact, there is an Islamic term for renewal and for reform. So just because we've been talking about traditional Islamic law doesn't mean that it always has to stay the same. Again, Sharia doesn't change, right? But fiqh can change. Fiqh has the methodology within it to change. Otherwise, you wouldn't have ijtihad, which is independent reasoning. You wouldn't have this idea of reevaluating the consensus of the scholars. So what's going on these days, then? Are there any modern trends going on in Islam? I don't know if I have a slide. Oh, I do. Okay. There are lots and lots of different ways. Okay, first of all, I have written here reformers, but this term is very problematic. Reform and reformers, it's a problematic term because a lot of people who are modern don't think of themselves as reformers. You know, they think of themselves as taking back Islam. They think that, you know, when my book came out, a relative by marriage actually looked at me and he said, "You mean you're a practicing Muslim?" And I could tell that, you know, I didn't fit his frame of what a practicing Muslim looked like. This is somebody I've known for over 10 years. And or people assume that I'm a reformer or progressive or an aberration, and I think of myself as traditional. And because I practice Islam the way my parents practiced it and the way their grandparents practiced it. So reform itself is a difficult term, but for want of a better one, I'm using it. What I mean is that there are lots of modernizing voices in Islam. There are lots of people that think that Islam and the modern world are not incompatible, that there is no conflict. I mean, I certainly grew up, you know, in Southern California feeling no conflict between being Muslim and being American. And there are lots of different ways that this is happening. There's a lot of debate in the Muslim world, and it's very exciting. So there are the traditionalist reformers, and these are the people who are taking the traditional Islamic methodology. They're the ones, you know, for whom fiqh is central. They use the methodology of the fiqh to develop other Islamic law. That doesn't mean that they're backward, again. It just means that that's their methodology in modernizing Islamic law. So, for example, Ali Goma, who is the Sheikh of Al-Azhar, or Yusuf Qaradawi, these are traditionalists, but they're also very, quote, progressive or modern. So Ali Goma actually said women can be imams. He backtracked a little after that, but, he said it. You know, Qaradawi has said that everybody can choose their religion. A Muslim can choose the religion. You don't have to be Muslim if you start out Muslim. And there's the freedom of religion is grounded in the Quran. The Quran says God made you into different nations and tribes so you could learn to know one another, and there's no compulsion in religion. So that is enough for him. So he takes a traditionalist approach. Other reformers don't take a strict traditionalist approach. They take a more creative approach. They use the traditional fiqh methodology, but they also use other methodologies and other modern interpretations that maybe were not considered before. They read the sacred texts by not being wedded to the fiqh. Tariq Ramadan, who is Swiss, is one of these. Mustafa Saric is the Grand Mufti of Bosnia, and he's one of these as well. And then there are, these are not very many, but then there are reformers who advocate reinterpreting the sacred text and disregarding the fiqh completely. The ones who say, you know, the fiqh is a product of all these medieval men. We don't want it anymore. We should just get rid of it and start again with the sacred texts. That's a little extreme for most people, but there are scholars who advocate that. And then there have been many, many women scholars who have been promoting women's rights from an Islamic perspective, especially since the 1970s. And what they've been doing is unreading patriarchal interpretations of the text and promoting women's rights from an Islamic perspective. So they've been saying, you know, this is what the Quran says, and look how the fiqh limited it. Look how these people, with their male 7th, 8th century worldviews, limited the interpretation of the Quran to their particular worldview. And why do we have to limit it that way anymore? Why can't we look at the Quran again? And it's very exciting work. Amina Wadud is American, and she's written a book called Quran and Woman, and she essentially does that. She goes back through the Quran and reads it again. There's Heba Rauf, who is a professor at Cairo University, I think, in Egypt. And she says, I'm not a reformer. There's no, you know, this is just renewal. This is, women's rights are rooted in Islam. Islam gives me rights. And I think this is really, really important. I work with a group called the Women's Initiative in Islamic Spirituality and Equality. And what we are trying to do is promote women's rights from an Islamic perspective. And I think promoting women's rights from any perspective is a good idea. If you want to do it the secular way, that's fine, more power to you. But for women who want to be Muslim and don't want to give up their religion and want to have a justification, they want to be able to say something, look, I am being Muslim, and I am promoting women's rights too, and here's how I do it. Here's my methodology. Here's the scholarship that tells me that Islam gives me these rights. So that's exciting work too. And what is interesting is that, in a way, it was Khomeini who opened up the door to women's movements. There's a very strong women's movement in Iran, and the way he did this is very ironic, because when the Muslim countries got independence from the colonizers, you know, they had these fractured identities. They had, you know, people speaking different languages. A lot of the religious institutions had been dismantled by the colonizers, or they had fizzled away for lack of funding. And the West, Western commentators had been saying Islam is backwards. It's not compatible with the modern world. You know, you're oppressive of your women. And so after independence, for Muslim communities to then start modernizing and to start giving women's rights was seen as caving in to Western commentators. And they were trying to find their own national identity. A lot of the turmoil that's going on in the Muslim world today, it has to do with nationalist ideologies. And so the door was kind of shut on women's movements, because anytime anybody tried, it's like, well, you're just trying to be Western. You're just trying to copy the West. You're just doing what they told you to do. But when Khomeini came to power and he started changing the civil code to take away women's rights, women started to say, what do you mean Islam takes away my rights? Islam doesn't take away my rights. Islam gives me rights. And they could then respond to Khomeini and not to the West. And so the dialogue became between them and Khomeini, and it opened up this door for women's movements in Iran and for other scholarship around the world. So there's a lot going on. We're not done yet. And no religion lasts for 1,400 years and covers a fifth of the world without being adaptable and flexible. So I think there's a lot of hope out there. Thank you very much for coming.
Our thanks to Sumbul Ali Karamali for her comments this evening. We have lots of questions, but first a quick reminder for our radio audience. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, where we're discussing Sharia law. I'm Gina Baleria. So we have just a huge stack of questions, and there's lots to talk about. I actually do want to start with a question that's the idea is prevalent throughout, and you were just discussing it, and it's women in Islam. And just to start with a different Ayan Hirsi Ali, whom I'm sure you know her writings well, not from the U.S., from Somalia, Ethiopia, who quickly just wrote, she believes, I'm sure many people in the audience know her, but she tends to think that it's difficult for Islam to be moderate. In her experience, she dealt with extremism and oppression in her worldview, and then went to Netherlands, where she spoke out and had a price on her head for a while. So she wrote, everywhere where Islamic Sharia law is introduced, you see the same features: abuse of human rights, returning back to a time of barbarism, hanging people, singling out homosexuals, going after them. There's academic Islam, and they tell you it's diverse, and then you see the way it's practiced. And, of course, your point about cultural worldview informing how it's practiced is well stated. But can you address a little bit, because it's like, you know, the Quran and everything that we see, it's like, wow, this is incredible. You know, this does sound like an incredible religion. But what we see on the news and what we hear from the places where we're, you know, like Saudi Arabia, even though it is extremist, we hear a lot from them because of the oil and because of Mecca and everything like that. Can you address a little bit sort of that other worldview that even some women in Islam feel? Sorry.
Yeah. I don't really see that as one question.
Okay, sorry.
First of all, Ayan Hirsi Ali is not Muslim. And she has never studied Islam. And she comes from Somalia, which is, it doesn't have a working government, where illiteracy rate is over 50%. People don't know anything in Somalia about Islamic law. You know, there was just a girl who was stoned to death when she was raped. You know, that's not Islam. I've just told you what adultery requires. It's not Islam to, you know, all these people know is that I've heard somewhere that if you have sex, then you get stoned to death. And it's a power play. This is what the Taliban are doing. The Taliban are also functions of a semi-literate Wahhabi education, very narrow, funded by the Saudis. I want to tell you first that the Saudis, plus the Somalis, plus the Sudanese, plus the Taliban, all together constitute less than 5% of the Muslim world. Half the Muslims in the world live in Indonesia, India, and Pakistan. There have been 5 Muslim women who have been heads of state of Muslim countries in the last 20 years, either prime ministers or presidents. That's more than you can say for the United States. So,
it's true.
Thank you. So I think, you know, first of all, you need to get the numbers right, because there is so much emphasis on the very, very few things that are going on, which are injustices, that you lose sight of the big picture. And a lot of these injustices that happen are not indigenous to the Muslim world. So, for example, 3,000 women are taken into sexual slavery in Guatemala. You know, hundreds of Hindu girls are taken into domestic slavery in Nepal every year. Something like 5,000 women in India are killed in kitchen fires for their dowries. I mean, these are not Muslims. This is what happens when you have developing countries and patriarchal cultures and illiteracy. And, you know, I remember at the beginning of the financial crisis, they were saying, groups were saying that they were afraid that women would be disproportionately affected by the financial crisis because when things get bad, women suffer disproportionately. It's unfortunate, but it's true. So a lot of what she talks about, I think Ayaan Hirsi Ali damages women. She conflates Islam and honor killings. They're not related. So honor killings are forbidden in Islam. She equates female genital mutilation with Islam. This is not Islamic. It's a cultural practice that goes back to the pharaohs, predates Islam by hundreds of years. It's practiced by Egyptian Christians as well as Egyptian Muslims. This is something that is just not religious. In fact, you know, when I went to this conference of 200 Muslim women from 45 different countries, they had something on female genital mutilation. And I would say 75% of the women were saying, "What's that? What is it? Have you heard of, what is this? What do they do?" Nobody had heard of it. Why? Because it's not a Muslim practice. You know, the Pakistanis haven't heard of it. The Saudis don't do it. The Turks don't know what it is. The people who do know are the North Africans. So, you know, so to be constantly saying it's Islam that's the problem, it's Islam that's the problem, Islam is backward, is just precipitating a hate culture that you don't want to go to.
So how can the majority of the Muslim community throughout the world, one thing I find very interesting in your book is something that I didn't understand, that there is no, you know, there's no pope, there's no one leader of the religion. There are scholars, and even they can be fallible or can be somebody can have a different opinion. So how, and you were talking a little bit in your book after 9/11, how it was very difficult to have a coherent response from the Muslim world, that people kept asking you, why hasn't the Muslim world responded? And you said, but they have, people have been talking. How does the Muslim community counterbalance this or get out what you're getting out today? I mean, beyond this community and who, you know, and educated people who listen to NPR, how can you get out there?
Well, I have to, I don't know if I should say this on YouTube, but, you know, I listen to NPR, and there's something almost every day that makes me angry about their Islam coverage, because it is very skewed. And as all the media, it's very difficult to explain just how huge the gulf is between media presentations and Islam. There's a very good book by John Esposito called Who Speaks for Islam? What a Billion Muslims Really Think. And it's the 2006 World Gallup poll that polled, if they did it right, the 1.5 billion Muslims around the world. And they asked them all kinds of questions. And, you know, and you would be, I think, surprised by the answers, because one of the things that they found, too, for example, was that although Muslims who commit violence is a fraction of 1%, 57% of the news stories that cover Islam and violence. So that's a huge difference. And I feel battered by the media. I feel like, I mean, my husband sometimes tells me, you're getting brainwashed by this media conditioning. So anyway, I have a friend who's a professor, and people ask him all the time, too, why don't Muslims stand up and say something? Well, first of all, what he says is, well, how would you know if they were standing up and saying something? And people feel very confident that their media would tell them. But, you know, I was listening to a news desk anchor at a big news station. I think it was CBS, but I don't remember. And she was saying that they get press releases from the Council on American Islamic Relations condemning terrorism every day. They don't put them on the air. They're not interesting. I mean, think back to when African Americans were thought of as criminals. Did you expect to see headlines saying African Americans are not criminals? No, that's not what the media does. So that is, you know, that is one issue. There have been so many efforts, I can't tell you. I mean, Muslim organizations are all you have to do is Google. There are so many statements by Muslims and Muslim organizations. There was a group that took out a full page ad in the New York Times condemning violence. There was, but it just doesn't get publicized. And in Jordan in 2005, there was a world meeting of over 200 Islamic scholars, all the big Islamic scholars from the world, from around the world. It's like getting all the Protestants and Baptists and evangelicals all in one place and getting them to agree on something. It was really remarkable because you had all these Muslims and they actually agreed on particular fatwas, one of which was that they were condemning violence. And all kinds of statements came in after 9/11. But still, you know, I still get asked all the time, why aren't you people doing anything? And sometimes I say, what do you expect me to do? And some person actually said, well, why aren't you out in the streets demonstrating? So it is hard to overcome. But, you know, until right now, I see the media as a big stumbling block. It is the single biggest factor responsible for our perceptions of Islam. And, you know, if you only focus on... let me give you an example. There was a woman who was murdered by her husband in... Well, she was allegedly murdered by her husband in New York. He was, I think she was, well, he reported her death. The police found her beheaded. It was very nasty. And he was arrested. All the media, including NPR, immediately started to say it was an honor killing. And honor killings are Islamic. And these are two presumptions. You know, one, that it's an honor killing. There are three American women on average per day are killed by their husbands or boyfriends in the United States. Three a day. So why is this not just domestic violence? Why is this an honor killing? And secondly, honor killings are not Islamic. You're not allowed to murder people in Islam. So, but we couldn't get over this thing in the media all the time, these presumptions. Now, at about the same time, there was a seven-year-old girl who was murdered. Her body was found, and a Sunday school teacher was arrested for her murder. This is in California. And if the media had taken the same approach, they would have said, this woman was a Sunday school teacher. She was Christian. There's a verse in the Bible that says disobedient children should be killed. Therefore, this was a Christian killing. Of course they didn't do that, and they shouldn't have. You know, it wasn't, obviously. And they shouldn't have done that. But they went out of their way to say, despite her being a Sunday school teacher, even though she had Christian influences in her life, this happened. So it's such a hugely different approach to anything. I was listening to someone who said, you know, if Muslims speed on the freeway, it's because they're Muslim. If there's a bank robbery, well, it's because of Islam. But it's a very hard presumption to get over.
Thank you so much for your response. Quick reminder for the radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Sumbul Ali Karamali about Sharia law. I'm Gina Bellaria. So now we get to the all of the nuts and bolts questions we want to understand better. Who adjudicates Sharia law cases, and can it be done in normal courts?
Well, Sharia is not really...
Oh, I'm sorry. I know you don't like that term. But say, for example, in Great Britain, where they're allowing Sharia for divorce and family cases, they're allowing Sharia.
Well, Great Britain is a different case. I mean, again, Sharia is not the law of the land anywhere. There are so-called Sharia courts in Saudi Arabia, but, you know, this is not something where Sharia law is being adjudicated. Sharia, there is no legal system called Sharia law that you are adjudicating. There are civil codes and constitutions that are being adjudicated. In England, what happens is there is a... In England, what you can do, and this is true for Orthodox Jews as well as Muslims, in certain cases, you can agree to an arbitrator. I mean, anybody can agree to an arbitration instead of going to the civil court. So if you want your divorce to be arbitrated, and then, you know, you can, if you both agree, if both parties agree on the arbitrator, and then you, and then what happens is that the judgment goes and is checked off by the civil courts. And as long as it's not egregious, then it's okay. Now, it's not that they're circumventing British law. Under British law, you can get your disputes arbitrated. And so for Muslim women who, they know they can get a divorce under British law, right? But maybe their family is telling them, no, no, you can't. Islam doesn't allow you to get a divorce. You can't get a divorce. Then they go to the Sharia council and they find an imam and they talk to the imam and the imam says, no, you can get a divorce. And here's is the document saying that you can get a divorce. So, and then the arbitration is settled. And so then they can say, look, I am okay from my religious perspective as well as from a civil perspective. So that's what's happening.
Okay. You mentioned earlier that someone who's Muslim can leave the religion should they choose. Is there any sort of specific Sharia guideline for leaving the religion, or can you just declare that you're not?
No, I don't think there's a Sharia guideline.
Okay. Okay. So this is...
But I don't know.
Okay. So one of our people in the audience asked, in Nigeria, if you were to be stoned under Sharia but switch to Christianity, you are free. I'm not sure if this is true or not, but if it is it true in other countries as well? I'm not sure if you're familiar with that. Okay. Okay, great. Now I have a stack of questions about Islam in general. Someone in the audience would like to know the difference between Shia and Sunni. Mm-hmm. And
that's an easy
how
one.
That plays out.
Okay. Okay, so when the Prophet died, there was some dispute over who should be the next leader of the community. And there was one group that said that the leader should be elected, and another group that said that the leadership should stay in the family of the Prophet. And the most likely candidate in the family of the Prophet was the Prophet's cousin. So what happened is that in this dispute, the one group prevailed. It was the group that wanted elections, and the Prophet's friend, Abu Bakr, became the next leader of the community, or caliph. Now, the group that had wanted leadership to stay within the family of the Prophet eventually began to be called the Shia. It's short for Shi'at Ali, which means the party of Ali, who is the Prophet's cousin. The other group who wanted the elections came to be called Sunni. So, and this was something that developed over time, but there are no real theological differences between Sunni and Shia. That means that there are no real differences between about the nature of God or the Prophet. They're more about authority. And historically, I mean, there have been disputes, obviously, but nothing on a huge scale, like nothing like the Protestant-Catholic conflict. It's sometimes portrayed that way, but it hasn't been.
You mentioned earlier that Muslims accept Jesus and they accept different characters or historical figures from different religions. But who is Jesus to the Muslim?
Mm-hmm. Muslims believe that Jesus is a prophet. So Muslims believe that God sent out many prophets over the years, and Jesus and Moses were considered prophets. So Muslims do not believe that Jesus is the son of God, but rever him as a prophet. So after we say the name of Muhammad, we say peace be upon him. But also when we say the name of Jesus and Moses, we also say peace be upon him.
And there's another question from somebody in the audience about the Old Testament. So the Quran, like the Bible, is built on the Old Testament. And the question is, how did the conflict between Muslims and Jews in the Middle East develop if their religions are based on the same text?
Well, I don't think it's right to say that the Quran is based on the Old Testament.
I'm sorry, I rephrase that.
What I said was that the Judeo-Christian tradition is accepted. And Muslims believe, I mean, Jews and Christians are called people, sometimes people of the book, but they're called, it's a better translation to say they're people of an earlier revelation. That means people who have received a revelation before. And they have an added layer of respect. I mean, Muslims can marry Jews and Christians and other people of an earlier revelation. The Israel-Palestine conflict, which I think is what this question is talking about, this is a political conflict. It's territorial, and it is not religious. Throughout Islamic history, Jews were actually treated very well. There were Jewish finance ministers, which would not have happened under the Jim Crow laws, for example, with African Americans. The Ottoman Sultan's doctor was traditionally a Jew. In 638, when the Arabs conquered Jerusalem, they actually invited the Jews back into the city to live and worship. So it is not true. I mean, what's being spread around these days, which really breaks my heart, is that Jews and Muslims have always been at each other's throats. And that's simply not true. And that really is stemming from the Israel-Palestine conflict, which is it's a political conflict. It needs to be solved through political means. That doesn't mean that both sides don't use religious ideology to further their agendas. Obviously, they do. But there is nothing in Islam that says Israel can't exist or Israel can't be a state or that there's any, you know, Jews are particularly well-respected people in Islam.
So unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's only time for one last question. And so my question for you is, what is your hope by speaking out about Sharia law and addressing communities? What do you hope to achieve and what do you hope happens after you give this talk today?
You know, I have to tell you, I was actually asked to talk about finance originally. And I realized that it was just so hard. And this was, I thought, more relevant to more people. And what I'm trying to do, in a nutshell, is just build some multicultural bridges. And religion is a very sticky thing to talk about. It's difficult. My father always told me, never talk about religion, politics, or other people's children. I try not to talk about other people's children. But here I am talking about religion. I try to stay away from politics, too. But the only reason I'm doing it, really, is I don't want to be doing it because it's difficult. But there's really a need for information. In our schools, we're not really getting the information on Islam. And certainly the media is making things so difficult for there to be any sort of a rational discourse. And so what I'm trying to do is just reach out to people and give them information. That's actually why I wrote my book, because I wanted to answer all the questions that I'd been asked all my life. And the books that were out there were textbooks. I mean, they were not easy to read. And I wanted to write a book that was readable and that answered the questions that people were asking me that were relevant, not about ancient Islamic history, but about how it all worked. What do Muslims do? What do they believe? I mean, what does it mean that you're Muslim? So that is my hope, that your being here is part of it, too. You're here to get information, and I'm hoping that with more information and more dialogue, we can get to understanding, because I don't think that there's any such thing as a clash of civilizations. I think it's the misunderstanding of those civilizations that causes clashes.
Our thanks... Our thanks to Sumbul Ali Karamali, author of The Muslim Next Door, The Quran, The Media, and That Veil Thing. We also thank our audiences here on radio, television, and the internet. I'm Gina Bellaria, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.